Hey, everybody. Welcome again to another episode of the Shop Notes podcast. I'm Phil from Shop Notes Magazine, joined by John Doyle, a designer for Woodsmith and Shop Notes, and Logan Whitmer, the editor-in-chief of Popular Woodworking. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about finishing, tool storage, and more. So you want to stick around. Don't forget to check out our show notes page, shopnotes.com/podcast, to find out about the free plan for this episode. Want to thank our sponsor for this episode is Epilogue Laser. You can quickly and easily customize your woodworking projects for added beauty and value. Learn more at epiloguelaser.com. Now, I have just got in yesterday a response. Last week, we had talked about some of our finalists for the Red Cedar Challenge. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys, Dwayne, had built a set of patio chairs and some tables. And he wrote back to clarify. And he says, just listened to y'all's latest episode, and there was some doubt as to the wood that I used in the chairs. I'm including a link to the lumber supplier. When you go to the site, blah, blah, blah. The name of the wood is actually Eastern Red Cedar / Juniper. So he did those chairs out
Okay.
Eastern Red Cedar and Juniper.
He brought receipts.
Yeah. So you have to keep in mind that I used a General Finishes outdoor finish, which gives the wood an amber tint. And if you go back and look at the photos, the tables are Western Red Cedar from Lowe's. And the chairs are Eastern. So last week I had said that I had thought that the tables were redwood when they're not. They're Western Red Cedar, and the chairs are Eastern Red Cedar. So there you go.
He successfully appealed to the judges.
My kids try that all the time, and they don't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Judges' ruling will allow it.
Yeah. So hope this clears things up, and great. Keep up the great work you all do in print, video, and on the podcast.
We have so many people fooled.
So anyway, I still think that's amazing. Well, it's even more amazing knowing that those chairs were done in Eastern Red Cedar, because normally it feels like a lot of that stuff is pretty knotty. All right, so there we are on the Eastern Red Cedar Challenge. I think next week we'll announce the winners and prizes for that. So,
I think they're all winners in my heart.
Right. I mean,
right here.
Simply by the fact that they submitted photos of their projects to the scrutiny of not only us, but the internet in general, makes them all winners. So, yep. We'll find something.
Yep.
All right. So anyway, one of the things that I wanted to talk about today is the concept of finishing. And what makes it a little poignant for me is one of the projects that we did for the TV show is a tall clock, the prairie style clock. The original one we did in cherry. The one we did on the show is in walnut. And I'm in the process of finishing it. One of the parts that I'm sort of dreading is the door with the like Kumiko style grid work in it.
Yes.
And what I'm going to do with that.
You probably remember this. Back on the show, early seasons, top five probably, we did that credenza that had a grid door on it. Do you remember this? And you dunked it into a pan of finish. And because of the way the takes were, we had to like break, and you like just held it in that pan of finish for like 5 minutes.
Yes.
It was supposed to be a dip, but it's like, okay, we stopped the cameras, bring them back. But that left like the smoothest, like best finish on it. So maybe
did it really?
Yeah. With like no drips like pools.
Just hold it in a
huge pan of finish. Yeah. Like a 6 foot this is a 4 foot door, 3 foot yeah. door, or whatever, with grid on it. So it's like you just need a dip. And I think didn't one of us or Becky share some sort of photo where they were dipping like huge entry doors into a finish or something?
Yes,
or stain.
That was like stain. Yeah, it was.
It's like, so this is a thing. This is legit. It's a technique.
Right.
We just need a vat of finish and somebody from the EPA supervising.
I had forgotten about that because, yeah. Yes, when we were doing the take for that, I feel like it was like a comedy of errors that there was, I don't know if a camera battery died, mm-hmm. and then like we had some traffic when we tried to restart again, and then there was something else. So yeah, I was holding that.
Yeah. I think it also gave you like polyurethane French tips.
That's right.
Very smooth yeah. fingers.
It's like those old Palmolive dish soap commercials yes. where it was like, your nails are great. Mm-hmm. So anyway, where I was going with that is I was wondering about, you know, it's real easy to get kind of deep into the weeds of specific products, but about like an approach to finishing. You know, because this is going to be a tall case clock. It's not going to see a lot of wear and tear. Let's be honest. Mm-hmm. So what, you know, like finding like what's the appropriate finish for it. And there's a case to be made for having, you know, confidence and competence in, you know, applying wiping varnish or whatever. But is that always the best case? Because I was thinking like the inside of the clock case is going to be somewhat visible because of the glass sides and the glass door and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that I want to go through the whole level of finish on there. So I was thinking on the inside, I toned the walnut with wiping varnish just to bring out those kind of chocolatey hues. Mm-hmm. And then I thought what I would do is I would just wax the inside. Because I don't really, you know, the inside of the clock case, other than being visible, I just want it to look nice. Mm.
Kind of like when you do like a drawer or a small box where it's like,
mm-hmm. yeah.
You just want to have a little bit of protection and color on the inside, but you don't need a full out finish.
Right.
Let me know how that goes.
I feel like that was yeah. a loaded comment.
So, yeah. No, I'm like, so I'm not the guy to ask finish questions, so go ahead.
I have a strong desire to see stuff with some, I wouldn't go as far as say a film finish, but I feel like if you take wood and you just apply, let's say, a mineral oil, we've seen Dylan mineral oil stuff before, it just doesn't look like a finish to me. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't feel like it has a finish. And I'm one to argue that I don't think mineral oil should be considered a finish, you know? I want something that's not going to look dingy after a couple years, which is what I feel like that mineral oil or some form of just penetrating oil does. I feel like it starts to look dingy. You know, like, either it okay. has... It looks dry, you know, maybe it's the case that it needs reapplied every couple of years or every, you know, right. the old, you know, rule of thumb with linseed oil is you apply it once a day for a week, you apply it once a week for a month or for a year or a month, and then you apply it once a month for a year, and then you apply it once a year. So you basically are saturating it and then you're doing maintenance coats, which I like that, but the level of surface finish, I think, to get to pull that off has to be significantly higher than what we do on the show. I mean, like, as far as I feel like you need to like super finely sand, like, you know, my dining table or my shaker little plant stand side table type thing. I took both those to 400 grit before I did my linseed oil because it stays nice and smooth. I don't feel like it gets, you know, dry looking. It looks like it has a sheen on it. I would almost, for something like the clock, I would almost do like an armor seal or something. Something that you can flood on and then just come back, you know, 20 minutes later and wipe as much off as you can.
Yeah.
Just to get some form of protection on there. Oh, though you did the wiping, or you did the tongue oil varnish, right? So you're kind of there already. So that
I view as kind of the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, I'm facing the same thing with, you know, I'm doing all this paneling in the shop. I'm doing Danish oil. It's going to be the same type of thing. It's like, you know what, I just need something to look decent. It's going to get dingy. It's a shop. So I'm not going for a film finish on it. But I just want something to add some color and add a little nice look to it. So,
yeah. So I guess that's what I was going at is, you know, I think there's a temptation in woodworking to, you know, we want our projects to last long and look great. So there's the idea that our finish should be kind of bomb-proof all the time. So, like, everything gets the same level of, you know, radiation-proof Iron Man suit kind of thing. When I'm wondering if there's maybe a little bit more thoughtfulness that could go into it on finding out like what's an appropriate finish for a project. You know, what are you hoping to get out of it? You know, like what the project is, what's its life going to be like? And then what are you going to do because of that as a finish?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a good consideration. I mean, I'm sitting at a patio table we built, God, probably two seasons ago, I think, is when we built that. And we did, I mean, we did a painted finish. We did a, the finish I did on the top was a teak oil finish. And it's one of those finishes, you gotta keep reapplying it. I mean, it's an outdoor oil, but you gotta keep applying it. Have I applied it? You tell me. That's a no.
It's a natural
patina. So, I mean, but like if you know that going in, then does it really matter? You know, I mean, I guess, yeah, you're right. I mean, when you're considering your finish, you got to consider what the end goal is and what it's going to serve its life as. So this table, it's on my patio. It gets baked by the sun all day. Like, I don't have time to apply it. I knew it was going to go gray. So what? I don't really care. It's fine. The painted base looks great still. I mean, it's starting to maybe peel in a couple areas. It was cedar, so it's fine. I just probably could use another coat of paint. Am I going to do it? Nope. Not going to.
Yeah.
So,
you know, not like I want projects to look like fake country style stuff where it's peeling paint and crackly and all that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, I feel like at least the types of projects that I make, I'm not going for something super high style where I need it, quote, to look shiny and flawless throughout its life. You know, it's going to look new from the beginning because it's new. But I guess I look at my projects, furniture projects, that they're going to live a life. And whether it's our dining room table that has bite marks on it from when my kids were teething, or homework where kids were pushing too hard with pens and pencils and, you know, spills and all that kind of stuff. Like, that just makes that table a little bit better. Now, the clock is not going to have that same kind of thing. So, again, I don't feel like I need to do heavy coats of polyurethane on it because it's not going to experience that same kind of wear and tear. Although, to your point, I do want it to look like it has a little bit of a sheen to it because it is a little bit more formal of a project than, you know, than like a shaker tall case clock would.
I don't know. Like, I think there's a place for that type of finish, for sure. Like, that opaque milk paint type thing. Like, I mean, I thought it was kind of cool. It's definitely like a, I feel like it's a much more utilitarian type finish than like a couple coats of spray lacquer. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you slap it on, it's good to go. I mean, I think some of it gets a little chalky, so you might want some form of top coat, but I was watching him do it, and it's like, oh, that's a nice, like, just, I build a dress for my kids, and they paint on it, and it's going, it's going to get beat to crap, it's going to get crayons and pens and stickers and kinetic sand and putty and slime all over it, you know?
Yeah, I kind of like that milk paint look, because it gives color, but you can still see wood grain through it.
Mm-hmm.
So like you were saying, I think that's a really good way to color like kids' furniture that you know is going to get kind of used and abused a little bit and add color, but it's not so like, it's not like paint where it's going to get chipped up and look bad. It's going to kind of age properly and look aged rather than just beat up.
Yeah. Well, and you know, one of my favorite articles that I ever seen on milk paint was from the late Nancy Hiller in, I think, Fine Woodworking. She had an article on top coats for milk paint, which was interesting. You know, you got this milk paint base, and then you can really change the hue, the tone, and really the feel of the paint by applying different top coats. So she had milk paint with wax on it, milk paint with linseed oil on it, milk paint with, you know, varnish on it, stuff like that. And it was really cool because you could clearly see there was a big difference in color and hue and sheen and everything, depending on what you put on it, which would be interesting to see what like a paste wax would do to it, you know.
Yeah, and I think what I like about what you were saying, John, with the milk paint is the idea that you can see the grain in it, and it's almost like a counterpoint to stain, you know, whereas sometimes stain, some people use stain to enhance the color of wood and to bring out certain attributes of it, and some people use stain to try and make something look like it isn't, and it ends up looking a little shabby in my view. Whereas I feel like with milk paint, it has some of the same effects of stain. Like you said, you could see the grain, but on the other hand, it is a color. So it kind of reinforces the overall form or shape of the piece.
Right. Yeah. It's like, hey, I'm still wood under here.
Yeah.
Not like some painted projects, like, I don't know, that could be MDF or melamine and just cheapens the look. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, yeah, like you're saying, kind of enhances it and still looks nice.
And then I also like that milk paint feels more, like you said, as it wears, it's not going to chip off. It's going to wear down in a sense. I guess the difference is a little semantic, but mm-hmm. You know, like other paint when we do on projects, it's house paint or interior paint on a project. And I don't know if that's the right kind of paint for furniture, even though technically you can put it on furniture. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that is right, just because it ends up feeling too thick or goopy looking or hard to get a decent look to it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. You definitely, with traditional paint, you have to be very mindful of the sanding and filling and stuff, because it's just going to telegraph all that stuff through it, where probably with milk paint probably looks a little bit more natural because you're seeing the wood. You know it's wood. If there's blemishes, you're just like, oh, yep, that's wood. So it's not as bad that way.
Want to give a special shout out to Epilogue Laser for sponsoring today's episode. They have a variety of options for you to be able to customize and increase the value of your woodworking projects. You could check out all the deals that they have going on over at epiloguelaser.com. Another aspect in that I wanted to talk about is, let's see if you guys think about it at all, is the the relative safety of using different finishing products. You know, like we use lacquer, spray lacquer all the time. I use it a lot. But I know that there's a lot of folk out there who want something that's not as chemically, for lack of a better word. Have you considered that at all when you do, when you create projects and then finish them?
No, I should. I was going to say earlier, I'm not usually the one to ask about like different kinds of finishes, because I always just revert to the spray lacquer, and because it's the easiest thing, is we always have it readily available. It's always going to be bomb proof, I guess. But then it's like, yeah, it you spray that and it seems like it off gasses for like 2 weeks. And you think you have it here in the spray booth, and you're like, oh, okay, it's good. And then you get it home, or you put it in your car to like, and it just totally fills the space with that, the fumes. And it's like, oh, it's not ready. But yeah. So yeah, it is, that is something to consider if, you know, timing wise, if you're trying to get a project done and finished inside of a living space, or you're moving it into a living space and it's just, you know, you have fumes and it always feels like sleepy time and
so, Christmas, yes. Smells like lacquer.
Right.
It's like, now give me the most carcinogenic finish you can and I'm golden. Like, because, and I'm going to say this, it's just generally because they work better, in my opinion.
Okay.
I do not like water-based stuff. I do not like it, Sam. I am. I do not like it with my green eggs and ham.
Yeah.
So I will always take like a, maybe not a spray lacquer, but some form of like varnish blend, like a tung oil or Danish oil or something. That's kind of always my go-to, or like a General French's Armor Seal. Now, there's absolutely, as John said, the pre-cat lacquer we have loaded up, there is no if, and, or but about it. It's like, it's loaded in the gun. It's ready to go. I'm spraying that SOB because it's done, you know? And it kind of, it gives you the same like oil look, but with a sheen. Now, I would be interested to see, because we always have satin lacquer loaded. I'd be interested to see like what like a matte lacquer looked like, you know, to see if that would give it a little bit better look, or it wouldn't give it a better look necessarily. It would give it a less plasticky look. Although there are some projects where I like a high gloss look on. You know, I know a lot of people are like, oh, you know, high gloss film finish looks like plastic. It's like, well, no, but sometimes I want that, you know. Sometimes that's the finish I want.
Sure.
Not most of the time. And actually, some of the best finishes that I've you know, put my hands on are some of David Marks' stuff. And his, everything he does is with Armor Seal. It's all General Finishes Armor Seal, and it's like 40 coats, and it's just 40 coats applied super thin, buffed off, and just keep doing it. Like, you're throwing away probably 87% of the finish you're applying because you're wiping it back off. But man, that 13% that stays on there, it builds up to a really nice finish. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't call Armor Seal like super caustic, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, going back to what you said about water-based finishes, that's what we used in our old shop here probably 18 years ago. And I don't remember when we moved, 16 years ago. We had to use water-based finish just because it was a small space and we didn't have, you know, proper exhausting and stuff, and just everybody using it. So we had to use water-based finish, and same way, I hated it. It just didn't look right. It, you know, wasn't, just was never happy with it. But some of Old Masters' new water-based finishes, they, you know, brought in, and we've used them, and it was pretty amazing. It seemed like it was a much clearer finish. Like, the before, it was kind of when I first started using water-based finish, it was kind of like foggy, or I don't know how to describe it, but it wasn't milky. Like super clear. It was kind of milky. And it seems like the newer stuff they have now, it's come a long way, and it's much better product.
Yeah. I mean, I used the last time Old Masters was here visiting us, I used their Masters Armor on like the video we were doing, like a door or something, and it lays mm-hmm. down beautifully. I will say that's the one water-based finish that I would give a chance. I would give it a chance, but I still like the warmth that oil adds. And it was funny. I was talking to Rob from Old Masters. He's their president, and he's like, "Oh, just put the natural gel stain on first." I'm like, "Well, if I'm putting the natural gel stain on, why am I going to go a water-based finish then?" Yeah. Like,
yeah. I'm going back to the loaded lacquer gun and just spraying it on.
Yes.
It's too easy here. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Got it too easy.
Yeah. So then what about, you know, there's folk out there who will stay, you know, like even water-based finishes are, you know, some kind of a complex chemical concoction. Then you have the people who are applying, say, linseed oil without metallic dryers with just a wax mm-hmm. added to it. So like an oil and wax finish, or shellac being a more natural, mm-hmm. low toxicity finish kind of thing like that. That would be a question that I have for people who are listening then is, are you using those, and are you satisfied with what it's giving you? You know, like everything, like my mom says, everything has a cost. So if that's the case, you know, you're gaining something in application or safety or, you know, its environmental benefits or costs, but you're giving up something else. You know, so how do you find that balancing act? Like where are we drawing the lines on that? That's a question that I would have, throwing it out there. Because on the one hand, it is sort of appealing, you know, to know that, you know, applying an oil and wax finish is, you know, I'm probably still going to protect my hands just because I don't want my hands all goopy and it's tough to clean up. But, you know, there's not a lot of unsavory chemicals that are in there.
I have used the linseed oil that I used on my dining table is it Tried and True? Is that the one that has no metallic dryers? It's actually like heated. It's actually boiled linseed oil. And that was nice. I mean, because I did still wear gloves, as you said. But, you know, a lot of guys were like, "Oh, I just apply it with my hands and rub my project down and stuff." And because, I mean, there are no metallic dryers. Yeah. And that, I mean, that was kind of nice. But then I think back to when I was like 5, 6, 7 years old, and I used to go to my grandparents' house, and my grandpa and grandma, I used to call them grandpa, grandma paint jigs, because I would go there and paint fishing jigs with my grandpa. So that's what we did. So that was their nickname. And I always thought it was the coolest thing. When we were done, my grandpa would pour this stuff on my hands that was super cold. Like, it was super cold to clean my hands off. I realized years later it's acetone. Like, probably shouldn't be washing a 5-year-old's hands with acetone. Yeah. But it was cool.
It's like, I got it in my blood.
Yeah.
Literally.
Because it was super cold.
Paint chip snacks. Mm-hmm. Lead paint chips.
Lead. Yep.
Yeah. No, and I remember doing oil-based paint with my grandparents or whatever, and then cleaning your hands with gasoline or something like that, just to get it all off. So anyway, those are all just random thoughts that I've been having recently about how to apply finish, because it's, you get comfortable with a certain finishing routine or regimen, and then you just kind of stick with it because you know there's a consistency there or a familiarity, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I sometimes wonder about choosing an appropriate finish for the project, and then also, you know, what are we trying to do with that finish, and what's the right pathway forward on some of that. So There you go. And the other thing that I wanted to talk about is tool storage. And where this came up a little bit was project that we're working on for the next issue of Shop Notes is a sanding tote that Dylan is designing and building. And then how that also intersects with you trimming out your shop, Logan, because you had talked about we had bandied about the idea of incorporating a narrow shelf around like the wainscot, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word, all the way around your shop as a way to just have a little extra storage in there. And you decided, what was your decision on that?
Undecided. I'm undeclared yet. Not declared which house I'm going in because I don't know. I meant to ask my wife yesterday, see what she thought. Originally, she said no, but then I made a little mock-up, and I kind of want to show her. Because, yeah, I mean, I got alder paneling on the bottom side, shiplap, wainscot, whatever. And then the top's painted. But so I need a transition between the two. So either I do a flat, 1x4 or 3/4 inch by 4 inch piece of trim, probably chamfer on the top and bottom, just to trim it out, kind of like we have in the shop where Phil's sitting. Or I do the same thing, but then I put a little top, like, kind of bullnose cap on it to give me, like, a 2-inch or 1.75-inch ledge all the way around the shop. And I talked about, Phil, I was talking about, how that kind of, I can't push stuff tied up against the wall then. But as he pointed out, there's always going to be outlets, so you can't push stuff tied up against the wall anyways. Now... I asked this question to my guys at Pop Wood, or Colin and Danielle, and said, hey, what do you guys think? Colin said, well, it depends on how much you like dust. Because, it's fair. It's going to collect dust. Dust is going to sit on top of that ledge. But there is a small convenience factor there. It's like, well, yeah, but then I have a ledge to, set my coffee cup on, or pencils, or pens, or throw my tape measure next to the bandsaw, or a can of glide coat or whatever, slick coat, I don't know, is it just another flat surface? Probably.
So. Plus, if you had a ledge there that collects with dust, you'll be able to see all the little mouse footprints as they run along your little ledge.
They run on the ledges. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So, but that tells me I need to get a shop cat.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anna would give a place for the cat to walk along, because that's a cat, right? Would walk along something like that.
Yep, that's true.
It's a catwalk.
Literally.
Yep. So, but yeah, I guess the one thing you had brought up, Phil, was, that would potentially serve as areas to mount tool storage around the edge, which I agree with. I think I could probably do the same thing with that 1x4 all the way around, and then just, screw on a little shelf right next to the bandsaw. And maybe that's the better option. I don't know.
Yeah.
A lot less work to do that.
Yeah. I mean, then you would incorporate the, that horizontal piece as like the backer to the shelf, kind of.
Yes, correct.
It would look a little bit more designed that way. I guess I was thinking about it because we've encountered some of that in the studio here, and I have it in my own shop where it's like, for example, at the table saw. We have the table saw up against a wall. Talked about that in a previous episode. And it's like, where does the miter gauge go when you're not using the miter gauge? Mm-hmm. Like right now, they kind of just sit on the floor, which is not ideal. Where do you keep like a push block, or, like at the bandsaw, I have just a real narrow push stick that I use for guiding a narrow piece in between a fence and a blade. And then I have a feather board or something like that. And it would be nice to have someplace handy for that, so that when you need it, you just kind of like reach right over and there it is.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, we kind of have that in the back shop a little bit where the table saws are. Well, maybe on Mark's table saw side, We have, you know, maybe an 8-inch deep shelf along that where, you know, push blocks and crap gets shoved. The other side, there is not a shelf, I don't think, but we have, like, the wall-mounted, you know, blade holder, and all the clamps are there and all that stuff. So that works out pretty well, but I do like having that shelf next to the table saw, because then it's like, oh, the Wixi digital gauge goes up there, or, oh, my bevel gauge goes there, or, you know, whatever, my push blocks go up there. So I do like that. So mm-hmm. I think that's something I'll probably incorporate somehow, some way.
Yeah.
Yeah, because on the other side where there's not a shelf, it's just everything gets thrown on the extension wing. Yes. It's like trying to cut something wide, and you're like shoving it all down and like piling it up.
You snowplow with it, yeah.
Yeah, just like shove it down.
I'm glad I'm the only one that does that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what we do here in the studio too. And it's not shown on camera very often, but, you know, stuff just kind of gets scraped off to the edge, or you just end up quick clearing the deck and moving it just off screen so that it's piled up somewhere else. And then you go back and then you need to use the workbench. So then you repile it back on the, cause I was also thinking of that. We did for the show, we did John's shop organizer, plywood shop organizer, which one of the reasons that I really like that project, and I think that we ended up choosing it for the show, is that it has a really nice balance between like highly functional utility shelving, but still looks nice. And I think it's really easy to default into just kind of stick it somewhere or clutter up any flat surface with stuff. We fall victim to that entirely too often here. But then I think there's also a tendency for some people to go all like H.O. Studley and have these little shrines and altars to specific tools, which I don't think is bad necessarily either. But having that, you know, having a good amount of organization helps you with the project. Like, for example, this sanding tote, that's where I was going with it, that Dylan's working on, is like, I'm going to make a really broad generalization here, but show me your sanding and sandpaper storage system, and that's going to tell me how well you sand projects.
Yeah. I get the correlation.
Because if your sanding blocks and sandpaper and discs are just all akimbo, thrown together or whatever, then that's how you're going to treat sanding, and it's going to reflect in how your projects look.
Oh, that's me.
And I know that because that's what I've done in the past, is if you can't find it or it's just kind of whatever and you're trying to get every last granule of grit off of that paper before you throw it away, then your projects are going to look like they're rushed for sanding, because you're like, this is dumb and it's taking way too long and I just need to put finish on it because I want this done.
Also me.
But if you have, you know, like your random orbit sander discs are kind of organized, you know where they are, you can get to them, they're near where you have your random orbit sander, then I believe you're going to be a little bit more mindful in how you sand a project. As incriminating as that is for me.
Yeah, if you're taking sanding seriously, you almost have to have like a setup like that, where it's like either a separate sanding bench, or, you know, something that you bring out to your workbench where you're just like, I'm concentrating on sanding right now. Like, that's the whole process. It's not like a, like you said, kind of a afterthought where it's like, okay, I'm done building, I'm just going to sand this real quick and move on.
Yeah.
So let me pull you guys on this. Now, I haven't looked at the sanding tote, really. I mean, I saw Dylan working on it. It looks like it's just designed basically as a drawer organizer for sheets, right? Is that about right?
Yeah, there's a little bit more to it in the sense that it's going to have on the bottom is like a removable tray that has a built-in sandpaper cutter. So that when you and then we're then the top of it, I mean, it's not like we're making little holsters on it or anything, but the top of it is to hold those solid wood sanding blocks that we did in shop notes. And then we did one, I don't know if we did it for video edition. I think I did it for video edition, where it's kind of a wedge shaped made from soft wood kind of sanding block that holds, I think, a quarter sheet of sandpaper.
Okay. So do you guys, because the way I approach some of this storage stuff, not just sandpaper in general, but like I like to get stuff in as compact space as possible because I got a lot of crap.
Oh yeah.
So I like to like condense it down. So like my sandpaper, I leave it in the box that I buy it in because I don't buy sheets. I don't buy sheets. Sheets are full sheets of sandpaper are stupid. I buy pads. And rolls of adhesive back. I leave them in the box that they came in. Those are all stacked up so I can see where the grits are. But once two boxes are like within, like I can combine two boxes, I put a divider sheet in there and then I combine them. And then I cross it out on the front of the box and write what grits are in there because it's like I'm keeping that crap all condensed down. So personally, I have a hard time expanding that sheet out into like a drawer system because I have a friend that's asked me about the same thing for turning discs, because turning discs are 2- and 3-inch discs and you get a lot of them and they come in just plastic bags and they're kind of a pain in the butt to store. He's like, oh, I want like a tackle box organizer with all of my discs in it. It's like, that's cool. I'm going to take my gallon bag that I could squish in a drawer and just...
You can vacuum seal all of them, just like suck out all the air and just,
yes.
And just put it in.
Yes, I want those as seen on TV, like shop vac vacuum bags, so I don't have to actually seal them.
Okay.
Come up with good ideas here.
Yeah.
We got some good tips.
Yeah.
Yeah. So point being is, you know, and where the idea came from is that a number of years ago in shop notes, we did a sanding tote that was designed around rolls of sandpaper. So it had two bins on the end that you could put, I think, between 2 and 3 rolls of sandpaper in there, and then had another kind of bin in the middle that had a lid with a cutter on it, kind of like, you know, your boxes of cling wrap or aluminum foil or whatever. So you could just peel some off, pull it out. So I wanted to come up with something, you know, have the design team come up with a concept that was in a similar vein, but for sheet sandpaper. Because, I mean, there are people who are like Logan and use adhesive back sandpaper. I'm falling into that too. And then there are also folk that love their sheet sandpaper. And that's what...
Sorry, it was a wasp.
And that's what they're using. So... This portion of the Shop Notes podcast is brought to you by Bug Assault.
Splatter your bugs' brains on your patio table.
Yep.
So, anyway, that's what I thought. And then it just made me think of, you know, like other organizers, because I feel like there is too often a schizophrenia in woodworkers that you have hand tools and they get these beautiful little precious containers and storage things, and all these, you know, really fine details and French fitted and clever racks and doors and whatever. And then it comes to your power tool stuff and it's like all the drill bits just get dumped into a drawer and you just dig them out when you need them. And power tools just kind of get thrown in a box or in a cabinet, all cattywampus. And And I feel like there's a middle ground somewhere.
Keeps them humble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so that's what we got. I would like your thoughts on how you store and approach storing your tools in your shop. Maybe some examples. If you want to send some photos in, you can do that at woodsmith@woodsmith.com. Just put shop notes podcast in the subject line just so that we can find out where it needs to go. You can check out our YouTube channel and write some comments there for watching the podcast and seeing some of the things that we talk about when we have show and tell. Otherwise, special thanks to Epilogue Laser and their cool products that let you customize and make some fun stuff. You can check them out at epiloguelaser.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye.